Hi, friends. It's time for another Best Of episode. A time to slow down, revisit some favorite moments from the last year, and gear up for another year of social science podcast glory. If you're new around here, you're listening to Opinion Science, the show about our opinions, where they come from, and how we talk about them. I'm Andy Luttrell. I started this show back in 2020 as a way to showcase ideas and research about public opinion and persuasion. I guess I don't really explicitly talk about me a ton around here, but I'm an associate professor of psychological science at Ball State University. I'm a social psychologist, and I study the nature of strong opinions and how they withstand or succumb to change. This includes things like how moralized opinions work, what happens when we feel conflicted, and how more emotion-based opinions differ from more belief-based opinions. And on this show, I talk to all sorts of people, like psychologists, political scientists, communication scientists, sociologists, in addition to writers, activists, and other people whose jobs put them in the thick of understanding public opinion in some form. Every year, I do this Best Of episode. I think it started because one of my favorite podcasts, which I've been listening to for like 14 years, does a very entertaining Best Of episode that is a highlight of the holiday season for me. So I figured, why shouldn't I try to do it? And then I just kept doing it. And now it would feel kind of weird not to. My hope is that it's a chance for fans of the show to remember a bunch of interesting moments from the last year, but also to help newcomers get a feel for the show if you haven't listened to any of the episodes so far. So here we are. This was supposed to come out on January 1st, and it was going to be this whole, like, ring in 2024. But I didn't have a chance to record this before the busy holiday season, and I was all set to wake up on Friday morning and record it and get it ready to go. But I had completely lost my voice. Came down with a cold, visiting too many tiny children over the Christmas season. And so, like, I had no voice to record this. Even now, I'm not, like, great, but I'm doing it. So technically, this is not coming out on the first of the year, and I think this is the only time this has ever happened, that an episode of the show is not coming out on schedule, but here we are. Bear with me. Thank you. But 2024 is a brand new year, and at this point, Opinion Science has been going for almost 4 years. That's wild to me. 88 episodes of the show, and if you count bonus episodes, a special summer series, and the odd rerun here or there, Apple Podcasts lists 121 episodes total. Not bad for a bi-weekly indie science podcast with no budget. So let's look back on 2023. As always, picking the best episodes is impossible. What does that even mean, the best episode? So instead, I've picked a handful of the 29 episodes that came out this year to highlight popular episodes and favorites of mine. I try to give a representative idea of the kinds of things that come up on the show and showcase a variety of guests. I've got 4 episodes of the main podcast and 2 episodes of a special summer series to revisit. So let's do it. Let's count it down. First up is one of the year's most downloaded episodes. This is episode 72 from January 30th, Fighting Against Misinformation with Sander van der Linden. I had Sander on my list of possible guests for a while, but I seized on the opportunity when his new book was coming out. You'll see it on plenty of lists of top behavioral science books of the year. It's called Foolproof: Why Misinformation Infects Our Minds and How to Build Immunity. I'll play a clip from our conversation where he talks about this set of strategies that people use to peddle misinformation. By identifying these strategies, his team has built programs to help people spot misinformation in action, avoiding it before it's too late. So to generate this set of 6 strategies for manipulation, did you do what he did? I mean, did you talk to people who engage in this kind of work? Or like, where did this list of 6 strategies come from?
Yeah. It's not some, you know, magical list that, you know, it's not exhaustive. It's just John Rosenbeek, who's a postdoc or research associate now in my lab, and he's been with us for actually quite a few years now, since the beginning of a lot of this research. We spend a lot of time trying to uncover the techniques that people use, you know, both through literature. So we looked at reports from NATO and other organizations who have done a lot of systematic reviews on information warfare and tactics like that are being used in the field. We listened to So we both had a mutual colleague who set up these events, and he would invite people, including some of the people who worked as a troll in a Russian disinformation forum, essentially. And we would hear about what their strategies were, you know, how they handled it, what was going on, and how people were duped. And so we went around and talked to the people who do this for a living, as well as some systematic research in the scholarly literature. And then we sort of combined what we thought were some of the most prevalent techniques at the time. And those were the 6 degrees of manipulation. And in fact, a lot of people ask me about this. Why aren't they kind of like broad? And it's like, yeah, they were intentionally broad. Because, you know, the more work we did later on, the more specific we got in terms of the techniques. But we often find that they're just subcomponents of these sort of larger strategies that we initially identified. So one of the techniques might be useful for people is called impersonation. But that can happen in lots of different ways. Fake expert just being one example of impersonation. And so that's kind of how we stumbled across these larger overarching categories that are being used. And that's kind of where we started. Yeah. And then, you know, there are more that I discuss later on in the book, but they can all, most of them can be traced back to some of these larger overarching strategies. And sure, you know, people ask emotion, right? But it isn't just emotion. It's using emotions to manipulate people, things like outrage or fear-mongering. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Some people are like, well, can't you use emotions to manipulate people for good causes like climate change or poverty? And in a way, the answer is yes, but it would still be the same in the sense that, you know, you're using a technique to influence people that might be misleading and is not transparent. And so we should be careful about that.
Can you give a flavor of some of the other ones as well?
Yeah, so the 6 are so impersonating. That's one. The use of negative emotions to scare people or to cause outrage. Polarization, so polarizing groups in society. So, you know, what people often don't realize is that misinformation. Well, this is an interesting side debate, whether the real problem in society is polarization or misinformation. But I think often the connection here is actually that a lot of misinformation plays into polarization. So a lot of misinformation is framed in a way to specifically tap into polarized debates that are happening in society. So polarization is well, not just political, but just trying to tear divisions between groups in society. And then we have trolling. So trolling is very common during elections and influence campaigns, basically, you know, setting up troll farms to sow divisions and use some of these other tactics like polarization. But it's also a technique in itself. So you're trying to manipulate public perception of a debate by creating fake accounts and falsely amplifying debates by, you know, creating bots. And then sophistication of the bot is kind of where trolling comes in. So you can have automated accounts that are very low quality, or you can have humans pretending to be somebody expressing an opinion online. So, for example, a lot of Russian trolls would pretend to be Americans and post about things like provocative content about relations between African Americans and white people, and issues that are on the nexus between like gun violence and things like that. So these were real people pretending to be, you know, I'm just this American sitting at home and I have this idea about, hey, you know, we should all not get vaccinated. Or then they would also say we should all get vaccinated to try to stir up a debate. And so that's really the essence of trolling and falsely amplifying societal divisions. And then there's conspiracy theories. So those are really part and parcel of misinformation now. But the thing I think that was interesting for us is that conspiracy theories often leverage a grain of truth. So what we try to do in our interventions, where we try to, you know, inoculate people, is tell people, if you're being too ridiculous with some outlandish conspiracy, nobody's going to pay attention, right? It has to be grounded in something real in order for the conspiracy to take off. And that's why they're often so influential. So conspiracies are obviously a big one. And I think the last one is called discrediting, which is really about saying you're fake news and trying to discredit other people using a range of techniques, you know, discrediting the mainstream media. I think Trump has his famous tweets where he basically says, you know, NBC, you know, CNN, New York Times, they're all fake news. And that's, you know, part of the discrediting of official organizations and mainstream media. And sometimes it just turns into whatever opinion you have that isn't aligned with mine, that's fake news. I'm going to try to discredit you. And so those are some of the strategies that we inoculate people against.
Number 2, second on my list this year is episode 77 from April 10th, Opinions in the Brain with Uma Karmarker. This one stood out to me because I loosely knew of Uma for one paper she wrote in grad school, but I stumbled across some newer work of hers and just reached out on a whim. I wasn't really sure how it would go. You never know exactly how people will lock into a podcast interview, especially if you don't already know them well. But I just had the greatest time talking with her. She's a rarity in the world in that she has two PhDs. She did a PhD in neuroscience and then turned around and got a PhD in marketing. So she has this very unique perspective on how brains navigate the marketplace. In this clip, we're talking about the limits of so-called neuromarketing efforts. But in terms of the hype, the risk of hype in neuromarketing, the number of times I see people throw the word dopamine around when they're talking about something that they have no business talking about dopamine, but there it is. Or, you know, people, as a psychologist, it does irk me when I see people talking about what is actually a psychology insight, but it must be framed in terms of what your brain does and the processes of neurons. And you go, like, yeah, obviously, but you don't have to talk about it as a brain doing those things. And so, you know, we know that there's this allure of neuroscience in the public as to feel like, oh, this is like the biology of how we do things, not this mushy psychology stuff. Nevertheless, do you see instances where in the promotion of neuroscience for marketing efforts, people go a little further than they ought to, and maybe some signs people can keep an eye out for as like, this may not actually be all it's cracked up to be?
Oh, goodness, of course. Yeah. But I think it's who's doing the overpromising, right? So I'm not sure we have enough time to talk about all of the things I would want to here. There's no buy button in the brain. You don't get a hit of dopamine every time you click a like. Like, that's just, you know, let's start a... No, so yes, the science-iness of something makes it feel more real and more... tractable, and you know, like you can argue it further. Oh, well, in the brain it does that, whereas just in your thoughts that wouldn't be a sufficient description. I agree with you that these things are problems. I agree with you that these types of research can be oversold. Sometimes it's not even based on research. There's an argument made about a dopamine response, and there's no paper that looked at that dopamine response. It's just a shorthand because it involved a system that also is involved in dopamine release, and therefore it's a dopamine response. So I think there are multiple places that this comes from. Honestly, some of it is science journalism. It's a good shorthand, or it's be an easier way to communicate impactfulness, to make it cooler and sexier and from the brain and with these chemicals that do these amazing things. Some of it is, you know, marketers trying to communicate within the field that the findings that they've made are impactful. So, you know, you have neuromarketing consultancies that want to impress upon their clients how effective their technologies are. And so they're trying to describe scientific results in a way that's catchy. You know, they're marketing. And some of it is the shorthand that we use. Let me take a tiny bit of responsibility. I absolutely give talks where I will briefly allude to the fact that, you know, I'm simplifying what fMRI does. And yet I will then talk about this area of the brain lit up, or, you know, as if that's magically the only thing that's happening in the brain at the time. So communicating the nuance is not always as impactful as giving these shorthand heuristics. And we know that heuristics are attractive, and we know that they don't lead to as deep processing. See, I read my social psychology too. And so they're going to be effective, and sometimes more effective, to the point that they overwrite the nuance that they were intended to communicate. You haven't asked, but I could anticipate the question on how to best prevent these things from happening. And I don't know is the correct answer. I think that a lot of us have made an effort, us meaning people who do this kind of interdisciplinary research, have made a direct effort to try and be responsible in the way that we communicate, certainly in the scientific research communities, in our papers, etc. In addition to that, communicating with the press, communicating with companies in this way, I will also say that there was a fascinating counterpoint, for lack of a better word, that was brought up by a professional who works in the neuromarketing space. So this was a person who works for a neuromarketing company, and they came to an academic conference. And one of the things that they mentioned is that, you know, Coke doesn't reveal their formula. And so when a neuromarketing company is trying to tell someone why something happened, they don't present all of the EEG traces. They just say, this person was paying attention because the brain told us so. And as long as it works, that is, as long as they are sufficiently successful above existing metrics in improving their clients' sales or advertising elasticities or whatever marketing target goal they have, there's a really open question for some of the people who work in these firms about how precise the communication of the science needs to be. And that happens outside of neuroscience too. That probably happens in many domains. So I think that that's a understandable reason that some of these claims can get blown out of proportion. On the other hand, on the other extreme, saying that you can tell what someone's thinking or that you love your iPhone like you love your mother or any of these other wildly, grossly overblown claims is, of course, inappropriate. The dopamine one really gets me because fMRI doesn't measure dopamine. Like, there's no... Also, dopamine, as you likely know, is an incredibly slow transmitter compared to everything else going on, particularly when we're talking about quick, pleasurable responses. And so the whole thing is just infuriating.
Yeah, I imagine people are thinking, yeah, I click a button, it just explodes in my brain.
Like a firework.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating. And on the third hand... Because that terminology has moved into the public space, it's now very attractive to use because it has its own meaning that people have interpreted. Mm. So people will often say, well, can't we just say the dopamine response? I'm like, no, we cannot just say that. There's this thing called dopamine fasting, which had, I don't know if it's still as much of a fad in the Bay Area, but it took, there were several think piece articles. And there's this whole trend for a while of what was called dopamine fasting. And the idea really was effectively stimulus reduction, right? So you kind of, you either meditate or you remove a lot of the outside influences that might have been reward giving, like social media or something like that. So you kind of unplug in the most literal sense, or you just, you know, take a break from all these outside stimuli or reward inducing stimuli or habit inducing stimuli. And it was called dopamine fasting. And I'm going, you know, if you actually managed to deplete the dopamine in your brain systems, you would have so many motor disorders coming out of that. Like, dopamine does all this, you know, there's all the cerebellar. So there's a lot going on that needs dopamine that has nothing to do with buy buttons or pleasure principles or anything else. But it's its own marketing term now. And I think that that's a real challenge.
Before we move along, I want to shine a light on an aspect of this podcast that sometimes flies under the radar. At the top of every episode, I do a quick segment that puts that week's interview in context. Sometimes it's just a brief reflection, but sometimes I spend entirely too much of my time researching and producing like a 4 to 5 minute audio story. If an idea strikes, I can't help myself. Some of my favorites this year include a story about the first printed misinformation in U.S. history in episode 72, the missteps in early attempts to study the psychology of jury decision-making in episode 87, and a dive into the times when social scientists have analyzed TV game shows to discover new aspects of human nature in episode 79. And another favorite opened up that episode on neuromarketing with Uma Karmarker that we just heard a clip from. So indulge me for a moment. I'm going to replay the opening to that episode, and you'll hear about some classic research that looked at people's brains to see what sorts of entertainment become popular. There's this new song I just came across online, and I want you to listen to it and guess whether you think it's going to be a hit. Here we go.
Oh,
you probably can't actually tell me if this one's going to hit it big. But what's weird is that your brain might. In 2006, some neuroscientists were hanging out on MySpace. 2006. Those were the days, right? And they downloaded a whole bunch of songs from unsigned and unknown artists. Songs that ranged from rock to country to hip-hop. They took each of these songs and found just 15 seconds around the hook or the chorus. Then, they got a bunch of volunteer human beings and loaded them into an fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance imaging, scanner. It's essentially a giant magnet that's able to periodically record which areas of a person's brain are working especially hard. So people are in this huge machine, and they get to listen to music. The researchers played those 15-second clips of unfamiliar songs and asked people how much they liked each one. Play a clip. How much did you like it? Play a clip. How much did you like it? But the whole time people are listening to these songs, the fMRI was recording what was going on in their brains. As far as anyone's concerned at the time, the study's over. They just, like, sit around for a few years. I mean, I'm sure they worked on some other things, but what they really wanted to know was how successful all of those songs would become. They had played 120 songs for people lying in that brain scanner, and 3 years later, they could trace 87 of them to a music database that also indexed the song's popularity. And sorry, MySpace musicians, but a lot of the songs turned out to be commercial duds. But not all of them. Some even ended up on albums that sold hundreds of thousands of units. The researchers wanted to know whether their focus group of people and their brains had been able to tell the difference between the duds and the hits. So first, if you just look at how much people said they liked the songs, their opinions didn't help identify the commercial hits. But look into their brains, and you have a different story. A clump of neurons that we call the nucleus accumbens was related to how much people liked a song, but it was also this signal in the brain that could actually predict future sales. The more people's nucleus accumbens was jamming out to a song, the more copies of an album containing that song were sold in the future. It seems that sometimes we can get a cleaner look at people's opinions by looking deep inside their skulls. Which sounds a little more macabre than I intended, but the point remains. The idea has come to be known as a neural focus group, and we now have a few more examples of them. One study showed people different TV campaigns to help smokers quit. And when they were surveyed, the focus group couldn't really predict which commercial would be the most successful. But you know what could predict which ads would actually get smokers to seek help? The patterns of activity in the focus group's brains as they watched the ads. In this case, the more a commercial tickled people's medial prefrontal cortex, the more influential that commercial would be when it actually aired on TV. Another study showed people sales displays for chocolate bars, and the way their brains responded was able to forecast how effective those displays were at getting people to buy the product in actual supermarkets. So our brains know some stuff. Thank goodness. But how far can we really take this? Based on these results, what have we really learned about the brain? What have we really learned about people's opinions? Is this a practical marketing tool or just a set of curious findings? Well, good news, because our guest today can help us sort through those questions. Okay, back to the program. But this might be a moment to mention that if you support Opinion Science and what it does, there is a tip jar. The podcast is a labor of love, but not without its costs. Hosting the podcast episodes and the website online, recording remote interviews, licensing music, and software for editing the show all come with price tags. And I was happy to have provided high-quality transcripts of all episodes to boost the show's accessibility, but I had to discontinue those because they got too expensive. So to help keep things moving and maybe bring back some of the more involved benefits like transcripts, you can go to opinionsciencepodcast.com/donate and click the PayPal donate button to throw some cash into the podcast fund. I've appreciated the support from a bunch of people so far. And also, there was an odd breakdown that meant previous contributions went without a thank you. That's a huge misstep on my part. And to all of you who helped support the show and were met with silence, I so apologize. I promise, any contributions from now on will come with a hearty note of gratitude straight from me. Okay, enough of this pledge drive. More best ofs. We're at number 3. And for this, I bring you episode 85 from November 6th, Having Curious Conversations with Monica Guzman. This one is unique in that Monica is not a social scientist herself, but she's done a lot of work on how people relate their opinions to each other. She helps people across the country have more productive conversations with people they disagree with politically. I reached out when I found out about her then upcoming podcast, A Braver Way, which really is great. So let's take a listen to some insights from Monica Guzman. I'm curious. I get the sense that through Braver Angels, you facilitate these kinds of conversations between people, or like workshops and things like that. So like you're hosting these kinds of interactions live, right? So you've seen them play out plenty, is mostly what I'm getting at. Okay.
Many times. Yes.
So like, I'm just curious to kind of get your take on like the themes behind these kinds of conversations for people who are new to them or apprehensive about them. Like, what are the things that people maybe struggle most with in the kind of learning phase of knowing how to do this? What are the kinds of things that people can do more easily than they expect to be able to do? I'm just sort of curious, like, when you see these play out, like, what are you seeing that is either consistent or inconsistent with what people expect out of these conversations?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm thinking about the Braver Angels debates I've been a part of, but also the many workshops that I've observed or, you know, helped with. One of the big things is people do tend to assume that the other side has no good points. And when they hear someone else articulate their point of view, and it's just a human, we don't tend to have a lot of like experts or, you know, heads of advocacy organizations, I mean, every now and then, but it's just regular people who are like, here's what I believe. I remember the very first debate that I saw was in April of 2020, and it was about the lockdowns and whether they should end because it's affecting livelihoods. And living in Seattle, I was very awash, of course, and like, you know, more of the left way of looking at it, which is like, lock it down. There's no question, like lives. But we didn't think about livelihoods as much because, hey, we're like working on Zoom in our computers. What's the problem? And so in that conversation, I heard folks from all over, from the Midwest, you know, all over the place talking about how afraid they were for their livelihoods and their businesses, and they don't know what to do, and they can't lean on their communities anymore in the way they could. And oh my gosh, it was so impactful for me. So this has happened over and over and over again, and I see it from other people too. Recently, we did a pair of debates, re-elect Donald Trump and re-elect Joe Biden. And I was sitting there, you know, because I'm liberal, I was sitting there in the re-elect Donald Trump like, all right. And, you know, even though I've done this work for a long time and I have parents who voted for Donald Trump and I understand their reasons, they're still very much of like, all right, see what you got. And I have to say, like, you know, I don't know, life is so complicated. And I did. I heard a lot of really good points. And so it's difficult to say that something was a good point. But honestly, here's what I think. I think that when you witness somebody saying something that makes sense, whether you admit it or not, in your own mind, you know it makes sense. You know. You don't have to admit it if you're not ready, right? But it does add up. And so I think people have that experience. One of the things that happens after a lot of workshops, so at the end of our workshops, we often ask people, how did it go? What's something you learned? We have a lot of people who say something to the effect of, from both sides, I can't believe how much media has made me believe these things that aren't true. I can't think of a single workshop where I haven't observed that being at least like 30 to 40% of the comments, you know, where people go, oh, I hadn't thought to actually talk to people, you know? And so that I've become kind of addicted to that. I think a lot of the people who do a lot of Braver Angels things have become addicted to that, where there's a source of information that is media, and we need it because hell, we can't go around understanding everything all the time, and we need trustworthy media. And there's some that's more trustworthy than others, and we know that. But there's a really useful font of information, which is just daily dialogue, you know, among different people in a diverse democracy. That's just important. It's actually critical. And we forget that, or we've just taken it for granted for a long time back when it was a lot more organic.
One of the things you said about how a surprise is that the other side has something reasonable to say reminds me of something I noticed in your book, which is basically that idea, right? That we expect people who think differently from us to have no good reason to think that way. And then we're surprised to find out, like, lo and behold, like, most of the time they do. I did have a reaction, though, where I was like, yeah, but sometimes they don't. Right? Yeah. Like, sometimes you ask people, you know, what's going on, and they really can't say anything, right? Because they just sort of, like, heard a catchphrase and are parroting it.
Yep.
But as I thought about it, I was like, that is more reason to have these conversations.
Yes.
And approach them from the perspective of curiosity. For the show I talked to, Guy Ichikoff, and some of his work looks at how being a good listener can just be the thing that helps people sort out their own opinion for themselves. And so by giving people the benefit of the doubt and being like, let's assume you do have a good reason for this, that actually might be a great service to you to go like, okay, well, I guess in this case I was right.
Yeah.
But also yeah. for the other person to like have that opportunity to engage critically and not be written off as someone who couldn't possibly have any good reasons. Like, that's a service to yeah. give people the benefit of the doubt.
I think so. And I'll say this too. I think that when people are confronted with the unreasonableness of something they believe, what we tend to do is turn the knife. Aha, see, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Right? And the more that we do that, the more that those people, instead of being in a humble place where they're like, you know, I think I was wrong about this, they're going to be like, screw you. You know, there's this and this. And they'll just reach for more reasons and they'll back away and they'll gone. And they're going to want to believe that thing that maybe you pointed out might not be right, just to spite you and all the people like you. You know, I think we do that to each other all the time. So there's still, even if you really do think you're right, the conversation about how right you are is just not a useful one past a certain point. So I saw this video on TikTok not too long ago where, you know, it was one of those series where like you put a mic in front of people, see what they say. And this was sort of a liberal leaning thing. And so they put a mic in front of a person who was more conservative on gun things. And the person was saying that more people are, what was it? Something like more people are killed by hammers than guns. No, really, they really, really are. And so, you know, the guy with the mic was listening a little bit and then he goes, well, you know, let's look it up. And so he looks it up. How many people were killed by hammers? A lot less than people who were killed by guns. And the last line of the video, and the video was a bit mocking, right? The last line of the video turns back to that person and he goes, but I'm still worried. I'm still worried that we're overreacting on guns. And I thought that was so interesting because what we tend to do is say, aha, I caught you in misinformation. You're lying about this. You were wrong about this. And then as if to say, so you're wrong about everything. So your point of view has no validity at all. But like that last line, the man was like, but I'm still concerned, you know? So our concerns, I think, guide a lot of times the data points that we want to glom onto, you know, or make us vulnerable to believing things that aren't really believable, but it's because they address our concern. And so what really needs to be heard is the concern. The concern is true. The concern is real. Talk about the concern. Because if you don't, people will continue to feel unheard, and they're going to just, you know, we're all going to spiral away from each other toward whatever. I mean, this is a complicated world. You know, like I grew up Catholic. I remember my mom, you know, just making the point that like you can pull anything out of the Bible to argue anything at all. It's a big book. You know, it's really, really big and complicated. So the same with our world. It's like, you know, we lord facts over each other, but it's like it's a complicated world. Listen to the concerns. That's what's leading people to want to grab on to certain facts or believe facts that aren't real.
I have a lot of ambivalence about these gotcha videos that you're talking about, and yeah. I'm a real sucker for them, and TikTok has learned this, because there is like, you know, there's a quiet vindication of being like, see, they don't know what they're talking about, but they also sort of terrify me, because I do think, like, if someone caught me in the same sort of situation and pressed me really hard on something that I actually think is probably true and valid, I might flounder in that moment. I might not be able to perfectly articulate where that comes from. And rather than treat it as an opportunity, which is what you could do, to be like, oh, maybe this is like I said before, like something that, oh, now I can sort of sit in this and really make sure that I understand, like, well, if it's not coming from here, where is this value of mine coming from? But instead, we throw it up as a 10-second video and go like, look at these crazy people.
Silly. Yeah, and everybody's doing it. Yeah. And it's so popular. And going back to my journalism days, that shit sells, you know? And it's complete garbage. The assumptions in it are complete garbage. If you catch someone in a wrong fact, or you can get them in a gotcha, you don't have to listen to them anymore. What is that? You know, as if it's all about just, you know, whack-a-mole. Well, yeah, it's whack-a-mole with arguments, right? But it's like, you don't make any progress unless you listen to the meaning underneath. And we have to do that.
Deep fans of the show will know what that music means. It's Hot SciComm Summer. For the second summer in a row, I hosted a special series of interviews with science communicators, people who help the public understand science through writing, podcasting, speaking, video making, and so on. It was another incredible lineup of people this year. They were all great, but I want to share quick clips from two episodes in particular. The first is with Allie Ward, host of the giant hit science podcast, Ologies. Just as I'd hoped from listening to Ologies, Allie was a total treat to talk to. Here's a very quick clip, but the whole thing is worth a listen. A lot of this is kind of like in the moments of doing the interview and then reflecting afterward. But I'm also curious about the before part of the equation and like what, you know, you could construe Ologies as a science show, but to me, it's like conversations with delightful scientists. Like that is the defining feature. And everyone I listen to, I'm like, how are all of these so delightful? Like,
right?
And I, like I said, I know plenty of scientists. I can tell you they're not all delightful. So I'm curious, like what the process of finding people or vetting people or like, what is that planning stage look like?
Oh, thanks for noticing that. I love finding an ologist. Oh, it's my favorite part of the job. Really is my favorite part of the job is finding who I'm going to interview about something. Sometimes someone says, you got to talk to this person about gall wasps. Wow. Have they got a lot to say about it? And they love it. And I hear from enough people, this is a guy to talk to about gall wasps. And I go, all right, I'm on board. Other times I say raccoons. I got to know everything about them. Who's studying raccoons so much? And I'll look up raccoons and I'll look up the genus for them. And I'll see, okay, Suzanne McDonald is a lead author on a lot of these papers. What's her deal? And so I'll go kind of different routes. And I think the reason why they're so delightful is because they're talking about the thing that they probably love the most or that they know the most about. And they're probably so delightful because no one ever cares as much as like we do about what they're talking about. Like, I have a friend who is a plant expert, and sometimes his wife will good-naturedly be like, don't talk about plants too much at this party. She's like a filmmaker, a different crowd or whatever. But honestly, I'll tell you, at a filmmaker party, these filmmakers want to hear about a botanist talking, you know? But for the most part, someone who studies barnacles is probably jokingly told, like, don't talk too much about barnacles. But then they come on my podcast and I'm like, you tell me everything you know about barnacles. I'm just going to sit here. You fire hose me about barnacles. And they're like, yes. And so I think you're catching them at like a moment of someone walking through the gates of Disneyland where they're like, here I go. I get to do my thing. And so I think that feeling celebrated is a great way to bring out the best in people. And when people come on Ologies, it's not like, okay, so you know a lot about barnacles, huh? I bet you don't know everything, and I bet what you know is probably divisive. It's like, no, it's a celebratory thing. And so I try to find people who seem like they are going to be excited to talk about it or will know so much niche content that they will appreciate the questions lobbed at them. And I've had a couple real stinkers, though. And sometimes that's fun. Like, the procyonologist in question who studies raccoons, Dr. Suzanne McDonald, I was like, what would the ology be for this? I'm pretty sure it'd be raccoonology because people have used the term in the literature. And what do you think about it? She was like, that's ridiculous. And I was like, ouch, cool. I love your honesty. You know what I mean? And she was like, raccoonology is not a thing. And I was like, what about procyonology? And she's like, that's a genus of raccoon. She's like, I'll sign off on it. And I was like, okay, we have an opinion here. Anytime you have an opinion, you got to be excited about that. You know what I mean? Because like if someone who's an expert has an opinion, you're like, that's dope. But yeah, I did an episode about aging, biogerontology. And I was like, this is the worst interview I've ever done. This guy hates me. He hates my questions. He scoffed at some of them. And he's a 79-year-old professor who studied aging since his youth. So that's got to be weird. I also had a list of questions for myself that I think one of them included, like, is it weird to approach death? And I was like, you know, but in my head, I was like, say that better. But anyway, we got through this entire interview. I'm like, this guy hates me. As soon as I turned off the recorder, he was like, great questions, great interview. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? And so a lot of that interview was like, asides are like, I think this guy fucking hates me. And so the reader, the listener is along for that journey of like, is this guy mad? And then at the end, the outro is like, you'd never believe what he said after I turned off the recorder. And so there's like a payoff. So sometimes the charm is in the irascibility. It's rare. But I learned this trick too at parties. If you don't know what to talk about with someone, you're at a party and you have social anxiety or you're neurodivergent, say for example, me, both, and you want to get someone talking, like ask them about something that they love. And it's, you know, if they're a couple, ask how they met. Before you know it, they go, oh boy. And you go, oh, this is going to be a good story. You know, where I was at a party recently. This girl had great skin. It's like, your skin's great. What do you use? Before I knew it, I had a whole recipe of serums. You know, I'm not a big serums girl, but I appreciated that she had really done her research. So asking people about what they love is a great way to get to know someone.
Okay, the second SciComm Summer episode I want to highlight is with Latif Nasser. I was so stoked for this one. My wife will tell you, I was so excited. Latif is one of the current hosts of the radio show and podcast Radiolab, which I've been a giant fan of for many, many years. And I've been a big fan of Latif's work on the show specifically and his work in other places too. And just like with Ellie Ward, I had known him as a friendly and fun voice that I had heard a million times on that show. But would the same vibe come through in an interview? 100%. It was a super fun conversation and a great chance to take a peek into the Radiolab machine. Here's a quick taste of the full episode.
When I think about stories that you do, the impression I get is that they're particularly good at putting me in a state of awe. There's like a thing about these stories where it's like, you just, like, I feel your excitement. Like I'm excited vicariously through you. And I think this is also done on the Netflix series,
oh,
too.
Oh, thank you.
So I also rewatched the Dust episode.
Oh, my God. That's my favorite one. Oh, I'm so
and it's just like, the whole time you're like, what? this thing has been going on this whole time and I don't know about it. And I don't know that I would feel that way if I didn't have this guide who was like, no, come on, you got to see this.
Yeah.
Like, and then you'll never guess, it also matters on this other continent.
Right. Right.
And so the other thing I associate with you is I get the sense sometimes that Radiolab puts you in a sound booth one day and said, we want you to say wow and whoa a bunch of times.
We do have
and we're going to sprinkle it in.
We have, that is a secret of Radiolab that we have. I don't think we have it now, but we used to have, like, there was in the Jad and Robert days, there was we called them Robo Jad and Robo Robert. And they were like, yeah, there was like a little folder of like, wows and, you know, zowies or whatever it was. I do feel like, and it's actually quite, I mean, a somewhat polarizing thing, but like, to me, I do feel like probably my one superpower more than anything else, is my enthusiasm. Like that's the thing I can get excited about the things I'm excited about. And that's a lot of things. And I think that's sort of my power, and I hope that it makes it more palatable for people to get into topics that they don't know about. Like there's something, like I feel so privileged to work at a show where people will listen, they will tune in, like, and millions of people will listen to something they don't know anything about. Like, how many shows do you do that for? Like, usually you're tuning in to either celebrities talking or like about news that you already kind of know a little bit about, or about, you know, a TV show you already watched, or about a sports match that you're about to watch or have just watched. Like, I'm going to tell you about obscure sport you've never heard of. I'm going to tell you about, for Sci-Hub, most of our listeners, like a website you've never heard of, or for, you know, like to me, I think that's really cool that we have that ability. And to me, I think the enthusiasm is in a way, it's like a way to promise, like, this means a lot to me. And I'm putting a little bit of my heart on the table, and like, and it's okay if it doesn't mean anything to you, but it means a lot to me. So, and I'm trying to share it with you in like, in good faith, and not ironically, or because I'm like, you know, angry about it or pissed about it. Like, I actually think this is like a beautiful thing that people ought to know. So that's really cool. It is polarizing. Like, there are people who are like, oh my God, I feel like I get reviews all the time and on every medium, basically, where it's like people are like, who is this guy? He seems so fake. I just want to punch him in the face. Like this seems so, you know, like it's so over the top. It's like, and I'm like, no, I'm actually like that. Like, I don't drink coffee. I'm just naturally like this. But to me, I think it's like, it's just a kind of, I don't know. There's a kind of honesty about it. There's a kind of like, I think it's a, yeah, it's a way to, I don't know. It's a helpful gateway drug into a topic you don't know. And it's like, that's a harder thing for a lot of people to do. It's to kind of venture into a topic that they know nothing about, you know?
It also strikes me as kind of a kindness to the people who you're featuring, right? They're sort of like, this is also like, this person is probably even more excited than I am. Like, and I just want to like, I want to amp you up so that like, you really can
that's
pay
right.
attention to this other person.
That's right.
And so, yeah, so that's a, so I guess like in nuts and bolts, is there anything you would say that you do to sort of like, part of this I think is at the pitching and rejecting stage where
yep.
you go, well, we're only going to do this if I am excited.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
But even still, you could be excited about something and it won't read on the
or,
radio.
Or so for so many of these stories, you're working on them for a long time. Like your excitement, it's there peaks and crests and like it troughs, you know, where there are moments where you're like, why am I doing this story again? What the hell? To me, I think one thing is to, when you first find an idea and it's like a little, you know, ember or not an ember, it's a little a glint of a whatever, flint of a whatever, spark was the word I was looking for. It's like document that, like do a voice memo to yourself or write a little, like, and my pitches for me are like kind of the. They're like compasses in a way. Like I write my pitches in a way specifically so that I can 3 months from now when I'm working on this thing and I've forgotten, like, I'm like, why does anybody care about this? Why should I ever, why did I ever care about this? I can read that pitch and be like, oh, that's why. Because I like, because it you know, scratches this itch or it answers this question or it asks this question or it I've seen a million stories like this, but I've never seen a story like that, you know, or who would, if I was in that position, I would have done the exact opposite thing than this person did. And like, what, wow, what an extraordinary thing. Or who would have thought that they would have found this thing in this place or whatever it is. Like the thing that actually is the hot center of the enthusiasm for you, like write it down. Like, don't trust that'll always be there for you. Like keep that and hold that and use that all throughout. And people are going to say stuff, what be they editors or people rejecting your story, or even people casually at parties who you'll start to tell them the story and then they'll be like, oh great. Oh, look, like a little miniature hot dog. I'm going to go follow that instead. Thanks. Like, that's more interesting than whatever you're telling me about. Anything that'll happen. Like, it's like use that thing as your sort of buttress to be like, yes, this is interesting. I know, cause I trust my old self. I trust this thing that I wrote that like, this is interesting and the world ought to hear it, you know?
Alrighty, folks, let's round this out. The last episode from this year that I want to highlight is episode 83 from October 9th, The Fundamental Nature of Opinion with Russ Fascio. Ooh, what a lovely experience. Anyone who does anything in the social science of opinions knows Russ Fascio's work. It is truly foundational. I was lucky to get to know Russ when I was a PhD student at Ohio State, and he was always so warm and curious and fastidious and excited about social psychology.
Russ was on my list of people to have on this show since day one. But since we live in the same city, I wanted to wait until there was a chance to talk to him in person. That day came, and the occasion warranted the full experience, so I booked time at the WOSU radio station. We met there for an hour and a half to catch up and walk through his long career of incredible insights. How could I pick just one clip? Well, I did, because this is a best of show and not a rerun. So here's me and Russ talking about the fundamental nature of attitudes for a few minutes. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about this automatic activation idea. This is within the last year or so. You know, I've known about this idea for ages, but only recently have I realized like how important that is. Like, I mean, that sells the importance of attitudes, that we just cannot help but be reminded of where we stand on something the second it appears in our field of view. But it is, I always find it kind of hard to talk about because it's an abstract idea, that this notion of like and dislike emerges automatically. Could you spell out, like, what do you mean? Like, when you envision that, what does it look like to you for an attitude to be automatically activated by some stimulus?
Well, I think it's probably easiest to understand if we just think of memory as really this is more of a metaphor, but you can imagine that memory just involves a set of associations, like salt and pepper, bread and butter. Those are nothing more than two terms that are associated. Well, if we think of an attitude in that same way, the working in memory the same way, then attitude formation amounts to developing this association between the attitude object and your evaluation of the object. And through rehearsal, through the sheer emotionality of one's experiences with an attitude object, through just observation of our behavior, that association could become really strong. And the stronger it becomes, the more capable it is of this kind of automatic activation. So any school child can probably tell you that the capital of Ohio is Columbus, but some elementary school children in New York, they might get the answer correct too, but they'd have to think about it a while, right? they'd struggle with it. They have to expend much more effort to retrieve that particular association from memory. Whereas the child that's rehearsed that association can do so much more readily. And I think the same is true of our likes and dislikes. Sometimes they're relatively weak, but sometimes they're relatively strong and have that capability of just emerging automatically by mere mention of the attitude object.
It might also help to unpack, like, how could we know this? Like, this just sounds like two philosophers talking about, like, what might be true about the brain. And short of, you know, calling up the gods and being like, how do we... Is this what happens automatically? How do we know? How could a mere mortal like one of us know that these are inescapable compulsions to be reminded of where you stand on something?
Very good question. And again, it's one that occupied us for a good number of years because we wanted to demonstrate and get a handle on that particular impact of attitudes. So there's a couple ways. An indirect way, it's not perfect, but it kind of resembles that Columbus is the capital of Ohio situation for the New Yorker versus for the Ohio resident. We could look at how quickly do they respond. So we actually spent a good number of years using that as our measure of what we called attitude accessibility, the ease of retrieving an attitude from memory or constructing an attitude in response to the question, whichever it might be. So we looked at what we called latency of response to an attitudinal query. Okay? So I present you with an attitudinal question. Do you like Starbucks cappuccinos? and I look at how long it takes you to respond, yes or no, or good, bad, like, dislike. And we can easily accommodate that in the laboratory with a task in which we instruct people that we are going to present them with the names of attitude objects, and in response to each, they have to, as quickly as possible, press a like button or a dislike button. And we're going to measure the latency with which they can respond. So in that work, we treated faster latencies of response as an indication of a more accessible attitude, one that was more likely to be automatically activated from memory. And we did a lot of work where we just used that kind of measurement procedure and found that attitudes, in fact, that people could respond quickly to when asked, were in fact more likely to have an effect upon later behavior. So we'd broken down direct versus indirect experience into something more fundamental, more abstract, that it was the accessibility of that attitude in memory that really determined whether the attitude had a strong effect upon later behavior. We even did some work where we tried to manipulate attitude accessibility. So could we make people's attitudes such that they were faster to respond to a query? Well, yeah. Just have people practice it. Say it over and over again. Cappuccino, great. Cappuccino, great. Love cappuccino. Right? That rehearses the association, and it grows stronger as a result of that rehearsal. And in fact, people then will respond faster to a query about their attitudes. But more importantly, if we go back to our puzzle paradigm, and we have people rehearse their attitudes toward these various different kinds of puzzles, just practice them over and over again, then we find that the attitude had a bigger impact upon their decisions during the free play situation. So that kind of attitude rehearsal actually led to the development of an attitude that was more impactful in terms of affecting later behavior.
And when you say you're timing how long it takes for people to respond to these queries, it's not like you're sitting there with your cappuccino and a stopwatch and clicking it yourself. Like, you're getting real fine-grained ideas about how long it's taking people to respond to this, which is also like a bit of a technological marvel within psychology that we can do something like that. And I mean, this was probably the early 80s, probably, when you started doing the response
early
time
80s,
stuff.
Yeah.
So what does getting pin perfect accurate reaction times in the early 80s look like?
I was very fortunate at Indiana University to have the support of a wonderful electronics shop. Hmm. So the very first work that we did involved a small Texas Instruments microprocessor. Microcomputers were not even available at the time, but this was a small microprocessor that the engineers were able to connect response boxes to, and we would present a slide on the individual's screen, and that slide would have on it, say, the name of an attitude object, like Starbucks cappuccino. And the individual was instructed to respond good, bad, like, dislike, as quickly as possible in response to each of these trials. The microprocessor would start its clock as soon as the slide actually fell from the slide projector down into the position where it was being transmitted.
It was a physical signal?
It was a physical signal in those early days. That would start the microprocessor's clock. The participant's repressible button would stop the clock, and that would reside in this microprocessor's memory for a very short time until the end of the session when we printed out, believe it or not, the results.
printed and it was just like a receipt of numbers.
But it was accurate. Yes, but it was accurate to the millisecond, which was amazing at that time. And those were the early experiments, all dependent upon that particular technology.
All righty, that'll do it for another bonus episode of Opinion Science. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. It's hard to know who all listens to this, but I know plenty of people do from all over the world. I don't think I mentioned this on the show, but my big news this year was that I was awarded tenure at Ball State. Thank you. And as part of my tenure case, I had fun playing up the podcast as one of the things that I do. I've heard from lots of people all over the world who listen to the show. I know plenty of friends in the field who tune in. Thank you. But I also love when I get emails from people who I don't know and who aren't academic social scientists at all, but have like really interesting questions about the things that came up on the show. I also hear from teachers using this podcast in their classrooms, which is incredible. So just like, thank you for listening and supporting the show. This is a totally one-person operation, and it happens in addition to the time I spend on my actual job. I spend entirely too much time on this project, but I do it because I want it to be fascinating and easy to listen to. It's all the more motivating to know so many people listen to it. Please subscribe or follow Opinion Science wherever podcasts live, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, wherever. Leave a review if you feel so moved, and check out opinionsciencepodcast.com for past episodes and other info, like how to leave a few bucks in the tip jar. Lots of stuff is already in the works for 2024. The year is kicking off with a bang, too. On January 22nd, I'm releasing all 5 episodes of a special podcast series that I produced in collaboration with the show Behavioral Grooves. It's called They Thought We Were Ridiculous, The Unlikely Story of Behavioral Economics. This is years in the making, and I'm so excited for it to finally emerge from our brains and hard drives, because it's just been one of those things that I never have enough time to actually work on, but it's always in the back of my head as something I could be doing. So I'm very ready to have it out there in the world. Keep an ear out for a trailer for that series in a couple of weeks, and then come back on the 22nd for the main event. Speaking of, I need to get back to editing that, and also finally writing that one paper, and also playing with my daughter. So, happy 2024. See you back in a bit for more Opinion Science. Bye-bye.